I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for the evening. Kathy and I first met Sister Maurice this past July on a beautiful retreat in East Dorset, Vermont. And we spoke to her and we talked to her about our meeting. And then several months later, I gave her a phone call, and as the booker of this group, asked her if she would please be our guest speaker on our very first group anniversary. And she impressed me with what she did and what she said. And what she did was she pulled out her calendar. And what she said to me was, "Well, that day seems to be free. God must want me to be with you that day." And that impressed me because it took the hook off of her. And right away she pointed to who was in charge. And the second thing that tells me is that, once again, she's off the hook tonight. If you don't like her talk, you can't blame her. You can't blame me. So without any further ado, please welcome our guest speaker for the evening, Sister Maurice, all the way from the Bronx.
Anytime they move the meeting to the church, whatever church it might be, I'm always reminded that this is as close as a woman in my church is going to get. Well, I would like to congratulate this marvelous and wonderful group for having its doors open a day at a time for a year now. You must be doing something right to be here. All those beautiful 24 hours of a day. My prayer is that you'll continue to be here for folks like me and for those who are still out there. In standing in a pulpit, I'm reminded of the story of the preacher who was going to give his first sermon. And he was very nervous about the whole thing. And he got to the church very early. And he was pacing up and down. And the bell rang. And he was supposed to get up into the pulpit to give his first sermon. And there was just one man in the pew. This was a farming section of our country, and there was one farmer in the pew. So the preacher went down to the farmer and he said, "You know, the bells are ringing. I'm supposed to give my first sermon. What do you think I should do? You're the only one who has come." And the farmer said, "Well, if I had a load of hay and I went out to feed the cows, and only one cow showed up, I'd feed the cow." And the preacher said, "You got it." Up into the pulpit he goes. An hour and then some later, he finishes. He goes down to the farmer and he says, "What'd you think?" And the farmer said, "Well, if I had a load of hay and I went out to feed the cows, and only one cow showed up, I don't think I'd give him the whole load." Now, if you didn't get that, you could talk to your sponsor. As Mike said when he was gracious enough to call me, my style is, if I open the calendar and there's an empty spot, I'm supposed to be with you. I truly believe that. If you don't hear anything I say this evening, please try to hear this, because it's the most important thing about me. I'm an alcoholic, which means one brandy, two brandies, three brandies, floor. I'm also a woman. I'm a member of a religious community. I'm an RN, a real nun. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, in particular the Forest Hills group in Queens, New York. That's my home group. And the last thing I always tell you about myself is my name. Incidentally, my name is Sister Maurice. One of the things that I'm partial to in our fellowship is that it's a fellowship of equals. There are no titles in Alcoholics Anonymous. No one really cares what you do for a living. I love that expression, fellowship of equals. I don't think there's another outfit in society that can claim fellowship of equals like we can. At least we'd match any other group that's out there. And so no titles. Yet you have never been anything else in this fellowship other than Sister Maurice. Isn't that a title? Well, I see it as my name. It's on all my important papers. It's on my driver's license. It's the name I've been using most of my life. It's written up quite well, two police stations, City of New York. But moreover, it's the name that I gave to you when I came into your beautiful presence a while back now. A call had been made for me, and I was to go to the Forest Hills group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really wasn't quite sure that someone of my class and caliber should be going to such a place as AA. So I was not a happy camper when I came. Little by slowly, thanks to you, that has all changed for me. So much so that I can say quite comfortably today, I choose to live the AA way of life. For a few years I said, I have to go to AA, I got to go to AA, I better go to AA. But you know what? I don't have to better or gotta. I choose to live the AA way of life. And when I talk about something being a way of life, it's not an incidental experience. It's not something I do when the spirit moves me. A way of life to me is as much a part of me as my right hand and my left hand. And that's the way I see Alcoholics Anonymous today. But for starters, I went to this first meeting. I went up the stairs, down the stairs, into a little room. There was just one man in the room. He took a look at me, came running across the room, grabbed my hand, told me who he was, and then he said, "What's your name?" I said, "Me?" He said, "Yeah, what's your name?" Oh, I said, "I'm Sister Maurice." Now, this man didn't say to me, "Your mother doesn't call you that, does she?" And he didn't say to me, "They won't let you stay here with that one." The very next thing the man said was, "Hi, Sister Maurice, you're welcome." And in my just 32 years with you, a day at a time, no one has even suggested that I call myself anything else. So I've never been anything else in our fellowship other than Sister Maurice. The name is important. It's mine. But the most important thing about me at any point on a clock is what I told you first and foremost. I'm an alcoholic. And each and every time I say that, beginning first, when I awaken in the morning, I don't know how you sleep. Of course I don't. But I sleep primarily on my right side. And when I awaken in the morning, I don't even know I have two eyes, because this one is buried in the pillow. Before I go looking for this eye, the very first thing I do, I announce before my God, I am an alcoholic. It sets the tone here. It puts me on the right wavelength. And any time thereafter that I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm reminded that of all the things I do each day that God gives me, my most important job, work, task, assignment is that I stay sober. And I do that best through the principles and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous as they have been written. When I came to you a while back, you gave me a book, and you called it big. I thought it was an interesting way you described the book. The gal who gave it to me, she was much shorter than I was, and she stood in front of me. And she held this book in two hands, and she said to me, "Here is a big book." No coincidence, I'm very far-sighted. And I looked over there, and I saw some fellows putting some shiny signs on the wall. And my eye hit upon the one that said, "Keep it simple." And as sick and all as I was able to make a connection. And I said to myself, wouldn't dare say it to the lady, I said to myself, "Boy, do these people practice what they preach." Because you can't get much simpler than that. Here is a big book. Of course, now we have the paperback, which I call the small big book. I don't call it the small book, because there's another book in the bookstore in the mall called the small book, and it talks about being an alternative to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I call ours the small big book. Well, you know, you introduce anything new in AA, and they send for you. And this fella came to me one night, he had a small big book, he's pacing up and down, he's saying, "Hey sister, you call this the small big book?" I said, "I do." He said, "That's a contradiction." I said, "What do you mean contradiction?" He said, "Small, big, small, big." I thought for a moment, and then I said, "We have had jumbo shrimp for years." Now, if you didn't get that, you could talk to your sponsor. And if you don't have a sponsor, well, as Paul Harvey would say, now you know the rest of the story. Well, I took the book from you, the one that you called big, and this is what you said to me. You told me I should read the big book. You told me I should study the big book. You told me I should believe what I found there. Then you told me I should share what I believe. And then you said I should practice what I share. And then you put that whole thing together and you said to me, "That is a design for living that really works." What did I know about anything? I said, "Let me see what I can do." And that design for living has worked so well for this lady here that I don't spend a fleeting moment of my precious time looking around for alternative ways to go. I need all the help I can get, believe you me, but it is always as a secondary measure to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol became a way of life for me in a very short period of time. It dictated my moods. It made my decisions. It said you will and it said you won't. I found it very hard to eventually surrender to the fact that whenever the first drink of alcohol went into this body, mind, and spirit, two things happened. One, I didn't know what my behavior was going to be like. And everything then began to center around, when am I going to get that next drink? I was a first grade teacher at the time, and I had the reputation in those days of being the best teacher in the school. When the children came to first grade after Labor Day each year, by the end of September, my kids were ready for college. So at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'd be working very hard with my class, and something would start in my body, mind, and spirit, and it'd be screaming in there, "You need a drink." And the very next thing I would do, morning after morning, I would put up against the screaming what people told me I had so much of, and that was willpower. And the willpower approach was futile. And I went on to learn, and I'm glad I did, that it wasn't that I was a weak-willed individual, but rather I was a diseased person. I was a sick, untreated alcoholic. And when you're in that condition, it goes beyond the strength of your will to satisfy what's going on in there. So I'd move to the next phase of the game plan. And I'd say, well, it's a couple of minutes after 10. These kids can go out to the bathroom. Then they can have their snack. I'll get the teacher next door to keep an eye on them, because I'm a responsible teacher. And then I'll run over to the convent, get a drink, and be back when this is all over. And I'd be running across the yard to the convent, morning after morning, and this would be my thinking. This is going to be my last drink, at least until I've done my day's work. I was too sick to recall in those days that at 5 a.m., when the big bell went off to get us into our day, my story goes back to old God's time, before we went mod. And we had this bell that went off at 5 a.m. And for me to get into anything in those days, I had to reach over from my bed and take that drink. And I hated doing that. And each and every time I did it, I would say, this is going to be my last drink, at least until I've done my day's work. The most fascinating thing I have learned about the disease of alcoholism is that it's that first drink. I thought maybe it was the 21st. But the most fascinating thing for me is that it's that first drink. And everything would then center around, when am I going to get the next one? And yet in those days, if you met me along the street and you said, sister, how many drinks did you have or will you have? I would have said two, because that's what a lady should have. And if you said to me, what was your behavior like or what will it be like? I would have said, steady as you go, because that's how I saw myself. But I know today it was very different. Also, if you asked me the question, who or what is the center of your life, I would have been insulted by the question. You just called me sister. You see how I'm dressed, every piece from stem to stern. You just saw me come out of that building called convent, and you're asking me who's the center of my life. How come you don't know the center of my life is God? And I would have been insulted by the question. Today, I choose to live honestly, thanks to you. And I have no problem in sharing with you that somewhere along the line, the focus shifted in my life. And it shifted from God to that next drink. I might say, too, because maybe someone needs to hear it, it was not one of my goals in life to become an alcoholic. I do not recall getting up a dark and gloomy day, a bright and sunny day, and saying, today's the day, Alky, by six tonight, watch me. I'll destroy me and see how many I can take with me. I do not see alcoholism as self-inflicted. I believe it is a sickness that comes to a person. I think it's a marvelous and wonderful idea that we have steps that suggest to us that in God's time we make amends, because we are accountable. But I don't hold myself responsible for the sickness that came to me. But I hold myself very, very, very responsible for the precious life-giving gift of sobriety that has been given to me. I did not get sober. I tried to get sober and I couldn't pull it off. I don't believe a person can get sober. That's my opinion. I believe something bigger, greater, outside of the person takes place. They call it a miracle. And I believe the precious life-giving gift of sobriety is given. And I believe it's given by one bigger, greater than all of us put together. I choose to call that one God. So I feel very responsible to take care of the precious life-giving gift of sobriety that God has given me. So much so that I have no problem in sharing with you. If you should ever hear that Maurice is back drinking, please, please, don't call me a victim. Call me a volunteer. And the very next thing you should say, somewhere along the line, she wasn't willing to do everything necessary to stay sober. I cannot plead ignorance today. You have taught me and taught me well how to take care of the precious, life-giving gift of sobriety that God has given me. Going back to the scene in the bed with the eye in the pillow, the second thing I do before I get out of the bed, I pray the Lord's Prayer. And when I reach the part of the prayer that says, give us this day our daily bread, I emphasize the word daily, because I want to remind myself that I will have sufficient bread for the day. He will not refuse anyone who asks for the bread, the help, but he only gives it a day at a time. It is my responsibility then to take that bread and to use it to take care of that gift of sobriety for the rest of that day. You know, there are advantages to years of sobriety. I've had them. But as the years of sobriety increase, so do the perils of smugness. Complacency is a killer. You know, the little sheep that strays from the flock. Maybe you know some little sheep. You know, the little sheep who says, oh, I know you haven't seen me at meetings recently, but don't worry about me. God is good. Sobriety is wonderful. The kids are in college. I'm in a new relationship. Oh, yes, you were so good to me when I came around. The little sheep that strays from the flock is usually the one that's found in the ditch, over the embankment, and hanging from the barbed wire fence. A favorite fruit of mine is a banana. And every time I eat a banana, I have a meditation. And the meditation is, the banana that leaves the bunch is the one that gets skinned. I have a drunk a lot that tells you quite well that all by myself I can stay very sick and quite drunk. But I truly believe I cannot stay sober and fairly well without you. I was affected physically, mentally, spiritually, socially, emotionally. Physically, I fared out pretty well. There were times I tried to arrange my own physical death. I used to leave the Bronx, go across the George, up the Palisades, pull over around Englewood, and I would say, when those cars are gone, when those folks are gone, I'm going to run this car over the embankment because I don't know what's the matter with me. And then I'd have what I call today a moment of amazing grace. And I'd say, I'll go get a drink and come back and do this another time. So I was not to die physically, but there are other ways of dying I'm sure you can identify. I suffered the death of my values. I suffered the death of my integrity. I suffered the death of everything I stood for as a woman, everything I stood for as a sister. All those areas of my life died. Outwardly, I looked pretty good, held a job, did it fairly well, tried to keep up with my responsibilities, and above all during this time, above all, I always said my prayers. And some of you have shared with me along the journey that you thought you missed the boat because you didn't pray enough. Listen, I prayed enough for you and all belonging to you. So this disease must be so big, and indeed it is, that something as powerful as prayer will not take it away. I don't believe you can just pray your way through alcoholism. And yet we say, where would we be without prayer? Prayer is a path where there is none. When all else fails, have I prayed. But I think for folks like you and me, there's another piece that goes with the prayer. Pray and row the boat. And this beautiful way of life enables us to do that, to pray and to row the boat. I denied that alcohol was my problem, and I was somewhat relieved when I learned that denial is the major presenting symptom of alcoholism. And when you're in denial from this disease, you are not in touch with reality. What I knew about my situation would fit on a postage stamp. What was happening in my life was as big as the state of New Jersey. But if I didn't have it up here when it happened, then it didn't happen, because I'd have it up here. Now, I had hundreds of people who talked to me about my drinking. Some of them wanted to be martyrs at an early age. The nerve of that one coming in here and talking to me about my drinking and my behavior. And why couldn't I see it? Because I wasn't in touch with reality. And there were many times that I exercised the denial. My mother was over there in Manhattan in the hospital for special surgery. She was there a long time. She had a total hip operation. She was there for months. Now I think they do it going up and down in the elevator. I went every day to be at my mother's bedside because that's where a good daughter should be. And one day my beautiful mother said to me, she said, "You know, if you don't come tomorrow, it'll be just fine. You must have a lot of work to do around the convent and the school. Why don't you skip a few days?" And I sat there thinking, wow, there she is with all her pain, and she's thinking of me. But I know today, because I'm in touch with reality, that my beautiful mother couldn't bring herself to say, "You're an embarrassment to me. You're no help to me. I don't need you around this hospital drunk." Now, I have just one sister, and she's also a sister. You get that? And during my active alcoholism, my sister secretly wished she joined a missionary community and lived in Mexico. It's very hard to be proud of a sick, untreated alcoholic. I know that today. I didn't know it then. Well, my sister came to the hospital to visit my mother, and she gave me one of those come outside the door kind of winks. I dutifully went outside. I figured she needed my help, my advice, whatever. My sister is very tall. She towers over me. Very soft-spoken like my mother. And she has a little thing that she does with her finger. So we're outside my mother's room, and my sister is whispering to me. And this is what she's saying. She's saying, "Why? Why would you come to this hospital at 4 o'clock in the afternoon drinking?" I was just about to give a lecture when it dawned on me. We've been down this road 100 times before. To the best of my recollection, not a word did I speak. But being a typical alcoholic, and that's all that I am, typical alcoholic, couldn't let well enough alone. So I took my right hand, the more powerful of my two, and I belted her. Shortly thereafter, two nurses came running down the hall and they are yelling, "Sisters, sisters." They were not calling us sisters because we were related by blood. But we were dressed like sisters used to dress. Some still dress today. My veil was on the floor. Hers was someplace else. Now, this is the famous hospital for special surgery. People come from all over the world to this hospital. And I learned a couple of years later that one of the major rules of the hospital for special surgery is that no patient leaves their room unescorted. They were coming out crutches, wheelchairs, all fours. Because the word got around quickly that there were two nuns out there killing one another. Now, in the midst of this chaos, I have a couple of thoughts. Interesting enough, I did not have the thought, maybe I shouldn't have belted her. I did not have the thought, maybe I shouldn't have had the last drink before I came down here. My major thought, as I'm looking up at my sister, is, why did she scream? That's how we have this chaos, because she screamed. Well, you know, I look back today with a sober, clear head. You know, it's perfectly normal. You belt someone, they let out a hoot. The other concern I had was my purse, which had fallen onto the floor, making a rather loud sound as it fell to the floor. I was a little distracted with the purse. I wasn't too concerned about the few dollars in the purse. I have a vow of poverty. I kept it quite well during this time. But I was very concerned about the pint of holy water in the purse. One pint of Christian Brothers brandy. And what is the thinking of a sick, untreated alcoholic? No one leaves here with that purse other than you know who. Now, there is only one word to describe someone who'd be in that position. And I had to go through a lot of other descriptions before, with your help, I could get to what's proper, right, and fitting. And if there's anyone in this gathering who still sees themselves in this first grouping, I would suggest that you leave that thinking here this evening. because it doesn't apply. I had to go through bad, hopeless, weak-willed, sinner, you should know better. But the way I would describe someone today would be sick, unwell, not playing with full deck, that's respectful. Or I heard a fellow one night at a meeting, he described himself, he said he was a quart low. I heard another fellow another night, he said he had a photogenic mind, he just never had any film in the camera. Well, I had to go a ways and have lots of help before I could see myself as sick and unwell. If you drink and you drive, you might miss the mark. I was always behind the wheel of a car. My first accident, July of 1970. My good friend, Sister Rose, was in court over the dismissal of a teacher from her school. There was a big to-do over there in the Archdiocese of New York. She had a lawyer appointed by the diocese, and I said, I'll be in court to help the lawyer help Rose. Now, how do we affect the people on the other side of the coin? The night before the trial, Rose called me up and she said, Maurice, please don't come to court. Not being in touch with reality, my thinking was, wow, there she is with all her pain and she's thinking of me. Well, I have heard Rose share her beautiful Al-Anon story, and indeed she was thinking of herself, and rightly so. It was not my style to push. I said, you know what, you'll have a lot of paperwork to do. I'll go to my classes, I'll meet you downtown at lunchtime, and you can brief me for the afternoon session. Well, I was in graduate school, and I drove well-fortified from the top of the Bronx to the bottom of my city, the Wall Street section of my city. It was 5 minutes after 12, lunchtime, a working day in Wall Street, and the weather was clear. Those are the things they tell you at the top of the police report. You know, it's important that you know the weather. A United States mail truck that was parked by the curb, minding its own business, got in my way. And I smashed into it. And when the policeman came on the driver's side, first word out of his mouth, you couldn't miss it. He said, sister. Now, it's a little taken back by the next piece. He didn't say, sister, are you hurt? Could I call someone? Do you think women will ever be ordained? He said, sister, could you have been drinking? And for a fleeting moment, I wondered how the guy got on the police force with a question like that. As was my style, officer, could I help you? So I proceeded to tell the officer about my friend who was in court, being persecuted, etc., etc. Well, I went into a blackout, eventually a pass out. I woke up in a convent a short distance away. I woke up in a strange bed, half my clothes on, half my clothes off. I didn't know where I was. I'm looking around saying, what happened? How did I get here? It certainly wasn't my custom then. And believe you me, it's not my custom today to wake up in strange beds. Well, I'm around long enough to know that you have your story, but I mean, you know. But at a time like that, we all have the same tricks of the trade. Where am I? What happened? And how do you get out of here? I put that game plan into operation, and I could hear some talking through a partially open door. And I tiptoed over. I was glad the door was open a little bit, so I didn't have to squeak it, you know. And, you know, I don't believe there's a smarter group in society other than alcoholics. I mean, of course, I'm prejudiced about this. But, you know, we don't go over to the door and throw it open and say, what the heck happened? You know, we're classy. We go over, you peek out, you see if you could see anyone, see if you can pick up a little something to go on, because you know from previous experiences they will be questioning you, and you know from nothing. So I peek out and I see Rose, and I knew as long as Rose was there, everything was going to be fine. The other sister was about 7 feet tall. Neither of us knew the lady. She was like a lunatic, yelling and screaming at Rose. And I got to the door, and I'm peeking out, and I'm listening as the big, tall lady screams at Rose. Your friend is on pills or she's drinking. And in order to help her, you are going to have to hurt her. Oh, I thought that was poor advice. So I took my eye and my ear in, went back to bed to get a little rest to handle Rose, who came in and asked the going question in our lives at that time. What happened? I told it as I saw it. I lost control of the car because I was so upset about the court case. Now, in those days, the car was in my mother's name. I had the car fixed, back out on the road. 3 weeks had passed. Every time you talked to Rose, she had this question. When are we going to tell your mother about the accident? Never. Why do you want to tell my mother? Well, the car's in her name. So what? The car's fixed. Then the fears that set in for a sick, untreated alcoholic. What if Rose tells your mother? So I called Rose up, invited her out for supper, my treat, took her to a little restaurant, leaned across the table in the restaurant and said, if you dare to tell my mother about the accident, someday you will come out of your convent. I'll be sitting in a car, and when you cross the street, that will be it. That is called threatening someone's life. Now, I always share that in my story, and one night 100 years ago now, that means a long time, I was speaking someplace, and we had a friend at the meeting. She's not in program. She came to hear me speak. And at the end, there was a little commotion, because she was pushing everybody aside. So she got up to me and she said, I have to ask this question. I said, what is the matter with you? She said, do you really think you would have run over Rose? Do you know, up to that moment, no one had ever asked me that question. Not even Rose. I said, let me tell it to you this way. Of myself, no. I wouldn't hurt a fly. As a little tot, teenager, young adult, in the convent many years, you wouldn't even see me. You could be standing in front of me and you wouldn't see me. What did I have to offer? I'm a nothing. I was like part of the woodwork, part of the drapes, always hiding out. You know, life comes from the inside out. That life is given by God. No one has been deprived of it. But because of our history and our story, we don't get in touch with the life that is in there. So I had so much stuff. I was so ashamed. I was always hiding out. I wouldn't harm you. But you know, you put one drink in here. The first one. And you can paint the most tragic scene you can think of. And I could be the one heading it up. And I always like to point out, because sometimes people think it's different because you're sister. It wasn't that I was at Mass the next morning or that I was reading one of my 10,000 religious books that I had in those days. And the thought came to me, oh, you shouldn't kill Rose. That isn't what happened. You know what happened? It was another moment of that amazing grace. And I also like to point out, do you know that that hasn't changed in 32 years of continuous sobriety? You put one drink in here, the first one, and you can paint the most tragic scene you can think of. It just wasn't to be part of my story or part of Rose's that I would run her over. Well, the disease was moving along, and one day I got a call from my boss, from the big boss. Now, in those days, if you got this kind of a call directly from the boss, it was in the same category as the Pope called you up and said, get yourself over to Rome. It was a very serious call. You never heard from the big boss. She'd have her counselor call you. She'd have her secretary, whatever. She called me personally. And there'd be only two reasons why she'd call you. One, you were in trouble, or there was a special assignment that only you could do. So I'm driving up to see the boss, and this is my thinking. I have enough to do. Why are they asking me? We get there, we have a little chit-chat. She says, Maurice, I'll get to the point. Some of the sisters are saying that you drink too much. In those days, you wouldn't ask a question. I asked a question. I studied when I asked it, but I said, well, where are they? And she got a little nervous because I guess no one ever asked her a question. And she said, they don't want to be mentioned. And I said to myself, they feared for their lives. And you know, in a very sick and negative way, I wouldn't recommend this to anyone. I was into one of our steps at that moment. Made a list of all people who had harmed me and asked God to be rid of them. And I asked her another question. I said, do you know anything about me? So she said, well, I have a file. She went over, she peeked in, she said, oh, I didn't know you were doing this, and oh, you're going to get this award, and there were trophies all over the place. She closed the file, and she said, you know, Maurice, I will never, ever again believe this about any of our sisters. I said, that's a good policy to follow. She gave me an apology, and off I went. And I walked back to the car, and I had just one thought. It was right here. She will never, ever, ever send for me again. She never did. Next time she arrived, unannounced, and put me away. So when I learned about denial, not being in touch with reality, it helps me. I like to keep things simple. You see, alcohol makes you feel fine. Therefore, you think everything is fine. Meanwhile, the people looking on are saying, oh, no. That helped me when I learned that. I was angry and resentful during this time, angry with God. I had given my life to God. What more do you want? I love the word relationship. You've been my teachers about relationships. Prior to recovery, I started this as a little tot, and I continued the same game plan into the convent many years later, trying to relate to God, whoever or whatever he was. I sat up straight, I knelt up straight, I disciplined myself. And you know, we didn't have the expression in those days, but do you know the expression that would have applied? Been there, done that. And then when I was drinking, it was taking God on. If you don't need me, well, I don't need you. Now, if I don't need someone bigger, greater, outside of this lady here, I wonder who I think I am. So I was angry and resentful with God. I was depressed during this time. I was in the convent many years before I picked up alcohol. Didn't like alcohol, didn't use alcohol. On the 5th of January, 1967, my beautiful father, Maurice, he went to God. And upon his death, when he looked eyeball to eyeball into the eyes of God, at that moment, I believe, is perfection for anyone. And I believe whatever you lack, you will receive at that moment. And that's how my father received sobriety, because he died of alcoholism at the age of 58. And I buried my father, and I went way inside, and I came out with a drink in my hand. And I can say quite comfortably today that my father and myself were carbon copies of one another, with one big difference: the way we were to receive the precious, life-giving gift of sobriety. So I was using alcohol to lift me out of a depression. I was getting more depressed. The bargaining stage. One bargain I like to share on. I got into my bed one night, rosary beads, my prayer beads in one hand, hanging onto the sheets with the other hand, praying away there. And I'm no sooner in the bed when I have to get up and get a drink. And I said to God, I don't want to drink anymore tonight. Please help me. I'll do more work for you and for your people. Please don't let me drink tonight. Well, see, the first drink of the day, not the 21st, the first drink of the day always has the final say. And of course, we had had that. So you get up out of bed, the rosary beads are all along in the dark, and find your hiding spot. And after I found my bottle and I took another drink, I beat that floor and I doubted the existence of God. How could a God who loves me, a God that I'm trying to relate to, how could you allow me to be in that condition? I'll bet there's no God. I live in downtown Manhattan, and when I'm in town, I drive on the FDR, the East River Drive, and I see our brothers and sisters, yours and mine. They're on both sides of the highway there. They build their homes there. They build them out of cardboard boxes and crates, and you see them frying an egg, and they need a jacket and a pair of shoes, and they have little brown bears. I only have one kind of brown bag. They have my kind and other kinds. And if those folks, our brothers and sisters, if they went over to the guardrail and they beat the guardrail and they doubted the existence of God, we'd say, poor socks, what they got going for them? I'm in a beautiful convent. I want for nothing. And alcohol brought me to the point where I doubted the existence of God. As we say in here, whether you come from Yale or jail, Park Avenue, Park Bench, what does it matter where you came from? I think it's very important to get to know your history, your story. But I put more energy into where do we go from here? Whatever happened this morning, yesterday, a week ago, a year ago, or 100 years ago, you have taught me to learn from the experience, but not to let it stand in the way of putting one foot in front of the other and being that person that God created you to be. And the other thing I did that night, I cried out at the top of my lungs, isn't there anybody, anywhere, who knows what I'm going through? Because each one in the throes of the sickness thinks nobody knows what I'm going through. Well, I didn't know you were up the street and down the road and over the mountain and down the hill going through the same thing. But I'm mighty glad that somewhere along the journey God saw fit that we would find one another in this beautiful fellowship. And it is God who has arranged our meeting. I truly believe that. C.S. Lewis, you've heard of him. He says in one of his writings about relationships, he talks about relationships in general. And he says it's as if God says to the people in the relationship, you have not chosen one another, but I, God, have chosen you for one another. If you think of the relationships that you have in the fellowship, would you of yourself have chosen those people? Maybe yes, maybe no. I like to think it was arranged. Like happened at the Gatehouse in Akron, Ohio, with Bill Wilson and Dr. Barr. And as a result of that arranged relationship, here we are this evening. It's really something when you put it all out there and reflect on it. Well, today I make bargains, deals, promises, commitments, and I follow through. I attribute that to one fact only. I don't drink alcohol while I'm sober. Very significant in Maurice's life. And the final stage is acceptance. The disease was progressing rapidly, and finally it all came to a head because I had two exceptional do-gooders in my life, my sister and Rose. And keeping it very simple, they snitched. They blew the whistle and turned me in to the boss that I had charmed a few months before. They brought the boss to my mother's where I was hiding out. I noticed a marked difference in the boss. She wasn't interested in anything I had to say. She spoke past tense, and she said things like, arrangements have been made. And they're expecting you in Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. I listened. She said you could go Friday or Saturday. I listened. And then she said, you'll be there for 28 days. And I said to myself, I won't be there for 28 minutes. Then she said, there you will find out what is wrong with you. And I said to myself, there isn't anything wrong with me. But you know, there isn't anything stupid about an alcoholic. And I knew the only way I was going to get out of this room and away from these three people was to say I'd go. Oh, I said, I'll go. I'll go Saturday. So I went out on an AA plane, American Airlines, the way I like to go. And there I met 64 beautiful men and women like you. The word got around quickly that we had this Catholic sister in treatment. One by one, you came to me. You beat up on yourself. You said terrible things about yourself. But you always finished by saying, you know, sister, this is a mistake for you. You shouldn't be here. You're not like me. Well, believe you me, anyone who thinks like I do is going to be my friend. I had a nifty getaway plan, but I scrapped it. I'm not one who sits around idle. And do you know by the end of the first week, I was a therapist. And And the word got around quickly. You don't like your counselor, you don't like the meetings, you're not getting it in group. You talk to that sister. She knows everything about everything. Now, every day at 1 o'clock, we had what they call free time. Well, you know, they'd say it was free time, and then they'd tell you what to do with it. We were supposed to stay in our rooms, read, write, listen to tapes. I always did as I was told. Since I was this high, all the way into the convent, somebody said jump, I jumped. Somebody said stop jumping, I stopped jumping. I talk about compartments. There's a compartment in here called power of choice. See, I thought the good people had that. I'm a nothing. Nah, God doesn't operate that way. If you haven't gotten in touch with your compartment power of choice, keep being faithful to this process that we have. And don't go it alone. And you get in touch with your compartments. So 1 o'clock every day, there you will find me. We had a nice table, tape recorder, pens, books. I'm going to do my assignments. I'd block out what happened yesterday. I'd be there 2 minutes each day. And I'd take the whole table and throw it clear across the room. Then I'd go to the wall back here. And I'd bang my head against the wall, yelling and screaming at God, why me? I've been so good. And this is what you've done to me. And my roommate had run out. She says she's at it again. Sometimes there'd be blood pouring out of my head. They'd come in, clean me up, calm me down. I'd be fine till the next day at 1 o'clock. I was too sick then. And long before that time, goes back as a little tot, to hear God say, you don't have to be good. You don't have to be good. You are good. That's a given. No one has been deprived of that goodness. Well, where does the bad come in? Oh, that's behavior. That's attitude. I try to separate that from the person. I try to separate that from this lady here. And I continue to chip away at my attitude and my behavior through that marvelous and wonderful process of recovery that we have. And I do it along with folks like you. And while that process continues, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, I walk very tall. I cannot help but be impressed at the goodness and holiness that sits and stands in this room. You know, I don't think there's another outfit in society that talks more about spirituality and a spiritual program than folks like you and me. You want to know the key to a life-giving, healthy, meaningful spirituality? Being in touch with your own goodness. Well, some 32 years later, and for quite a while now, I have a why me question of God. Not why me, why am I an alcoholic, but why me, why am I sober, since most people don't receive this gift. And he answers very loud and very clear. And he says the same thing all the time to me. He says, Maurice, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. The big book says, God did for him what he could not do for himself. And he says, many are called to the disease of alcoholism. Very few, a drop in the bucket, are chosen for the precious life-giving gift of sobriety. And I say, well, why me? And he says, well, make your little chart. I make a little chart. I headed alcoholism. I put a simple line down the center. I put on this side of the chart, all of us in recovery, round the world. Fairly big number. But you put on this side of the chart, all those who are still out there. You wouldn't even see us. I find it awesome to be on that side of the chart. And I don't want to take that for granted. Oh, yeah, I'm sober. Big deal. What else is new? I don't want that to be my attitude. So I do the why me. Well, we've established I'm on that side of the chart. Why me, God? He says, Maurice, how do you see death? 100 years ago now, that means a long time, I sat with death. I found it so negative, so terrible. How could God do this? And I read a line that I had read many times before, but this time I experienced a moment of amazing grace. And the line is, there's a time to be born, and there's a time to die. And that's on God's calendar. And I believe any person goes to God in death, regardless of age, circumstances, when their work here on earth is finished. I may have more work for that person to do, but on God's calendar, their work is finished. And the other thing that helps me about death, I'll see those people again when my work is finished. God is not a yo-yo. He's not, well, I'm going to take this one because they didn't do this today and that one because, you know. No, God doesn't operate that way. But your work is finished. Makes sense to me. Well, the point. Untreated alcoholism is still listed as an ultimate terminal condition, 100% fatal. And here we are. Well, I believe our death has been interrupted. Of course, our work's not finished. You know, there'll be tragedy in our world tonight. Some people will go to God, their work is finished. Others will be saved, their work is not finished. Those who are saved, I don't know what their work is. More will be revealed to them. I believe our work is defined. It's a specialized work. It's to carry a message. It's to walk with. It's to pass it on. It's to be that fellowship. With all due respect to the church, the medical profession, other forms of help, they do a lot for us. But there's just something about one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. Like happened at the Gatehouse in Akron, Ohio, with Bill Wilson and Dr. Barr. And as a result of that sharing, here we are this evening to celebrate this anniversary. Well, on the 27th and a half day of the 28-day program, I got up and there was something different about me. Because up until that time, I had been mouthing, I'm an alcoholic. Because I wanted to get out of that facility on the 28th day. But on this particular morning, it was something different. And I was crying, and I was laughing, and I'm saying, I'm an alcoholic. I'm really an alcoholic. And I went to my counselor, a beautiful Lutheran minister, and I told him I really believed I was an alcoholic. And this counselor, this beautiful man, he did something that he had never done in any of our sessions. He started dancing around the room. And he said, I have a prescription for you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, if you're faithful to the prescription, you will only have to return here as our guest. I said, I won't make any promises. I'll see what I can do. And by that amazing grace, as it operates in rooms like this, and my cooperation with the grace, you know, we know the program works. How many powers of example do we have that the program works? But if we don't work the program, it's not going to work for us. So by my cooperation with that grace, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or any substitute since April 17th, 1971. I am not one who says I will never drink again. If I thought I would never drink again, perhaps I wouldn't be as faithful. Early this morning, I asked for daily bread. We'll see how tomorrow goes. I came into the rooms and I did the old 1-2. I didn't drink and I went to meetings and I went to meetings and I didn't drink. And I could always be found sitting in the third row, waiting for this thing to be finished, but they weren't going to say that I wasn't there. And one night I heard a fellow share, and this is what he said. He said he learned unless he put the 12 suggested steps into his life, and made some changes, he could very well lose his sobriety. And I sat up real tall, put a little smirk on my face, because I was sure the man was going to say, "We don't mean that," for the little sister there in the third row. And the man never said it. And with the help of my sponsor and a few other folks, I learned why I was so miserable. "Oh, I heard you say, change or die." I used to poke the one next to me and say, "Isn't there something in between?" But that's what it comes down to. If you're an alcoholic, you're always in motion. You're getting weller or you're going back. You're changing or you're dying. No big deal about that. We have a marvelous and wonderful process to follow. Beautiful men and women to walk with us. And all I have to do, what is my responsibility? I'll try. Let me see what I can do. And as a result of getting into our 12 suggested steps, little by slowly, changes started to happen. And I can put them into three categories, and they continue to happen right up to this moment. The first had to do with the intellect. You know, I had thinking that went like this: ready, fire, aim. I had postage stamp thinking. And we talked about that. And you said, "Maurice, see what you can do with those steps. They'll do wonders for your head. And it is amazing how bright and shiny and how broad is this picture up here today." So I had what I call an intellectual conversion. And then the moral conversion. My value system went by the wayside. And that bothered me terribly. And we talked about that. And you said, "Maurice, give yourself time. Work your program to the best of your ability. Don't go it alone. And you'll be able to put first things first and second things second. And when you're wrong, you'll be able to promptly admit it. And you'll be able to practice the principles in all your affairs. And you'll be able to practice the principles and you won't have affairs." And I took the suggestion. And as a result of that, I've had a moral conversion in my life. And then the third was the spiritual, which came for me in two parts. When I heard you talk about spirituality, I was glad that you had a little something. But see, I have religion. You know, when I came to meetings for much of my first year, I could not walk into a meeting room like this. I had to go in sideways because I had these flags in my ears. Catholic, Catholic, very, very Catholic. And we talked about that. And you said our program teaches us balance. And you helped me to get a balance with my religion. I have the same religion that I was brought up with. You also gave me a wonderful, marvelous technique that I use with my religion and I use in many areas of my life. I take what helps me and I leave the rest. You see. Then the spiritual. I said, "Well, tell me, what is this spirituality?" You said it has to do with relationships. Oh, and I said, "Isn't that great? I'm interested in that." You said relating to God, a higher power. Oh, I wanted to get into that. And then you said relating to other people. Well, I wanted to get the hang of that. And then you said it also includes relating to yourself. Oh, I said, "I'll never have spirituality because there's nothing here to relate to. I'm a nothing." And you said, "We'll help you get in touch." And you helped me to get in touch with what is the true meaning of love your neighbor as yourself. You helped me to get in touch with what is said, to thine own self be true. You helped me to get in touch with the fact that if it is virtue to love my neighbor, how can it be, must be virtue and not a vice to love myself? And as I chipped away with the stuff that kept me from the light and the life, little by slowly did I get in touch with the marvelous and wonderful woman that I am. What I do is not who I am. Whether I do the marvelous and the wonderful or whether I do the terrible, that's a whole separate issue. I cannot help but be impressed at the goodness and holiness that sits before me. So I've had the spiritual conversion. When God gives the gift of sobriety, and I believe it is given, I believe we are chosen, because our work's not finished. He says three things. One, I'm interrupting your death, because your work's not finished. Carry a message, walk with, pass it on, be that fellowship. He says, secondly, with this death that I'm interrupting, you will have fellowship. Folks will come into your life and you will come into theirs. And he says, third, with this gift of sobriety, I give you your dignity. Walk tall. And so my prayer for you, as you continue on the road to recovery, is that you'll continue to have your sobriety, your recovery, if you happen to be in another program as well. And as a result of that, I just know, you'll have your dignity. Through no virtue of ours, we have somehow been chosen, snatched back from a grave, from degradation, and clothed again in the robes of human dignity. May we never underrate or take for granted that gift of sobriety that is ours. I close, the miracle still takes place. I close with the short version, of Maurice's story. I am sure you can identify with it. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And may God, however you understand that God, may God bless you and God bless me and God keep you and God keep me, because nobody does it quite as well. I'd like to thank each of you for coming to be with me on this, the most important day of my life. It's not my birthday. It's not the anniversary of anything in particular other than the group anniversary. It's just simply the only day I have. And when people come to be with you at such a significant time in your life, like the only day you have, you try to remember them, at least I do. And I'll try to remember you, because you're here with me on this, the most important day of my life. Thank you very much.